Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting live and video streaming live from our studios in New York City. And I welcome you. We're now carried all over the world. And as a result, we try to address issues that impact the larger group of humanity, not just something local. There are many other stations that do a good job of addressing local and community issues. We don't address celebrity, sports, local politics, national politics. Instead, we go after the hard-hitting issues, health, the state of our minds. So what we think is what we do. So are we doing the right thing? Are we thinking the right thing? And that's what we focus on every day. And I appreciate all the feedback. Today, you have asked about, could it happen here? What happened in Cyprus? Could our government, would our government, confiscate our funds? We're going to ask two of the leading experts on the topic, both professors, Professor Ellen Brown, who's also an attorney and is now president, chairman of the Public Banking Institute, and Professor Paul Craig Roberts, one of the most progressive analytical and economic commentators in the world. Those two will be addressed that question. Also, I have some information that I'll share with them to see if they were aware of it, about who got taken advantage of and who didn't. Then, continuing with our series on environmental issues, I'll share the latest on the colony collapse is increasing exponentially. So this year, 50%, half of all the bee colonies are collapsing. That's a big deal. That's a changer. Why? Because one-third of all the food that we consume is pollinated by insects and birds. But the bee is the most prolific and best at it. What's killing them? We'll discuss it. Also, biodemocracy or corporatocracy, the food fight of our lives. We really need to hear this. This is a part of our new series called Public Health Issues. There is a move underway, and it's succeeding, by Monsanto and DuPont and others, to control our food supply. They're wanting to patent all life. And they just crafted a piece of legislation that they wrote, that their lobbyists managed to get passed by both Democrat and Republicans working together with Monsanto and against the American public. So we need to hear about whether we're going to side with GMOs or with our right of freedom of choice of healthy foods, and GMOs are not healthy foods. Of course, anytime we do an important 1 or 2 hour documentary on the air, which we've done 2 hours of original in-depth reporting this week, we received some feedback. Specifically, it was about the safety and efficacy of vaccines. The Gardasil vaccine was specifically targeted in the polio vaccine. And from what I'm told, though I didn't hear it, Dr. Vicki Hufnagel made some comments where she disagreed with some issues. So we'll address what she disagrees with today with one of our scholars and residents, Richard Gale. But also we have some brand new information today that ties perfectly in alignment with what we are claiming. What we're claiming and what the actual real independent scientific literature shows is that we have not eradicated polio. We've simply renamed it. And when Bill Gates was confronted by a reporter and asked, would he take any responsibility for the vaccine, polio vaccines in India that have led to 49,000 paralysis cases? He said it wasn't true. Well, he's wrong. I'll follow up on that. And of course, that part of her discussion with Bill Gates, I would absolutely agree with. One of the problems with some of the alternative media is they take one point of contention, but then they extrapolate it into areas that are not of substance. So we're only going to focus upon, are vaccines causing paralysis? are those paralyzed people being reclassified? And we'll discuss that. As you see, we have a lot to share, and we always start with the latest on health and healing. I think that we should be consuming a lot more apples. Now, green apples, I have a green apple juice every day, quart, and I put in 3 lemons, the skin and all, and the green apples, because there are specific acids and phytonutrients from those green apples that are important for detoxifying the liver, keeping your blood clean, helping get rid of parasites and unhealthy bacteria. It's just a great tonic. A smaller amount, let's say 6 ounces of green apple and lemon, you could take with a teaspoon of apple cider vinegar, organic apple cider vinegar. That's terrific for rebalancing the pH in the body and also helping you with pains in your local joints or muscles. Last night I counseled a woman who has stage 4 cancer and has metastasized. Now, there's nothing at all that she's been given at Sloan Kettering that's going to help her. She's been given enough of hillbilly heroin over there, that's a euphemism for one of the painkillers, that she's not feeling pain, but her protocol is not going to get any better. When I ask her about what is she doing nutritionally, nothing. And I'm surprised, at least I thought, that they would just get out of denial for a second, a heartbeat, to look at all the new major advances in clinical nutrition helping a body, especially one with cancer. Here's something that everyone in this audience could do. And I believe it will go a long way in helping prevent cancer, but if you know someone who has cancer, this is a great nutrient for the body. You take apples. Let's say you take 6 apples, red apples, doesn't matter what variety, and you peel them. Now, you can use the pulp of the apple for juicing or making applesauce or drying the apples, which is great. But we're looking for the skins only. And then you take those 6 apple skins and you throw them in a blender. And you put some modified citrus pectin in. Modified citrus pectin. You also put in there about 5,000 or 6,000 milligrams of curcumin, indole-3-carbinol, or a scoop of broccoli or cruciferous powder. That would be your best. And then you blend that with, put in some vitamin C, black cumin seed oil, and you blend that up and you take that down. That is a very powerful anti-cancer, phenomenally healing beverage. You have to adjust the taste. You can add something to the taste that will make it more palatable. You could put a couple drops of stevia in there, which would, you know, give it a little sweeter taste. Here's the latest. And again, we only use mainstream peer-reviewed science. This is apple extract. Kills colon cancer cells better than chemo drug in latest test. I'll quote this. They're talking about the oligosaccharides, that's the active ingredient in apples, that, quote, killed up to 46% of human colon cancer cells in vitro and outperformed the most commonly used chemo drug by a wide margin at every dose level tested. And unlike toxic chemo drugs, these saccharides are natural, health-promoting compounds widely present in fruits and vegetables. That's important. That was from Ethan Evers of Natural News. Now, colon cancer right now is the second deadliest cancer that we have, especially for women worldwide, and third cause in men. You go into a hospital, if you have colon cancer, you're going to get surgery, chemotherapy, radiation, and some combination. All of that has serious side effects, including coronary spasms, neurotoxicity, anemia, and immunosuppression. Researchers focus on apples as a natural means for treating and preventing colon cancer because they're the most widely consumed fruit in many countries, the banana in the United States, but elsewhere it's the apple. And also, apples have hundreds of studies on them. Apple juice, apple cider, apple vinegar. Apple's just a miracle fruit. And we should be consuming an apple a day. If you consumed, an organic, of course, if you consumed an organic apple a day, an onion, a sweet onion, a day, garlic bulb, a whole bulb, per day, you would go a long way to preventing all kinds of illnesses. Now, of course, you can be very creative in how you use those. You can lightly roast the garlic and then mash it up and then stir that mash into any number of dishes. I love it with yams or sweet potatoes. And it's a different way because it blends in with the sweetness. So you're getting the sweetness of the sweet potato and the sweetness of the roasted garlic. Roasted garlic is sweet. And then if you put your healing oils on there, almond, walnut, avocado, coconut, olive, any of those oils, then you're really getting something good for you. In any case, the apple saccharides were used because they're known to have anti-cancer properties from various other studies. And so now you know it. Apples in concentrated amounts and fresh apple juice with the whole skin and drinking down a blend in a blender from the apple skins, you're going to beat any drug out there. And yet, you're going to be safe and healthy. This is something that you rarely see where they're making a suggestion. This is the Journal of Clinical Rheumatology and also the VU Medical University in Amsterdam. Here's what they say. Treat your rheumatoid arthritis with antioxidants and fish oil because they're shown to relieve both conditions. Quote, rheumatoid arthritis is an autoimmune disease, meaning that for unknown reasons, the body's immune system begins to attack and destroy its own tissues. In rheumatoid arthritis, the most damage occurs to the cartilage in the joints, typically in identical joints on both sides of the body. These joints become red and hot and swollen, resulting in difficulty moving and severe pain. You can also get lumps under the skin, inflammations around the tissue. Now, normally, there are two different drug classes that are used, the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, which battle the pain, and the disease-modifying anti-rheumatic drugs, many of them immune suppressors. They're designed to slow the progression of the disease or to even send to remission. Well, they both have serious side effects, including death. This study showed that when using antioxidants, a spread that was only 1 ounce, actually less than an ounce, of an antioxidant-rich spread each day over 10 weeks. And then they used 400 milligrams of alpha-tocopherol and 10 of lycopene and 10 of lutein and 5 of palm oil and carotene and vitamin C, 200 milligrams. These are all small amounts. Quote, plus fish oil. Researchers found that at the end of the study, participants had significantly fewer swollen and painful joints than they had at the start of the study, and their overall health had improved. So that's good. And the fish oil, quote, by far the most well-proven natural rheumatoid arthritis symptom treatment is fish oil and the omega-3 fatty acids. At least 13 separate double-blind placebo-controlled studies on more than 500 participants have shown that the omega-3 supplements significantly reduce rheumatoid arthritis symptoms and actually enable patients to lower the use of their drugs. All good. So there we have it. Ways of helping people. Now to our environmental segment. I'm hopeful that within the next 12 to 16 months, I can complete a major documentary on the 12 tipping points four of those tipping points have tipped. There's nothing we're going to do that's going to protect us. We simply have to adapt to the circumstances, including the rising of the oceans. They are going to rise. My big concern is, and I've asked people all over who are experts, when? There was a time when they would have said 100 years or 200 years. Now they're saying it could be any time, including now. And that's because no one that I've spoken with in science was prepared for quantum shifts. They're looking at incremental shifts because it might have taken 100 years, 200 years for climate to worsen. But once it reaches the tipping point, you can't control it. And there's no mathematical model that says you don't have to worry about changing your population's concentration near the ocean. Not true today. And I think Sandy will look like a back rub compared to the beatdown that anyone living on the ocean is going to get over the next 2 years. This is the latest to confirm what I've been telling you. Quote, this is from commondreams.org, reporting it. This is from the peer-reviewed journal, the most respected journal in its field, geophysical research. The rate of global warming is speeding up. Despite the apparent stagnation in the rise of global surface air temperatures that may have prevented people from recognizing the danger of the climate problem we face, a new study in the current Journal of Geophysical Research says that in the past 15 years, we've undergone, quote, the most sustained warming trend. The researchers attribute this missing heat phenomena to the fact that 90% of overall global warming goes into the heating of oceans. And the oceans, quote, are cooking. The myth that global warming has slowed, which is frequently cited by climate deniers and perpetuated by fundamentally flawed studies that they use, like the Koch brothers studies, do not account for the warming of deep ocean waters and has had a dangerous effect of lulling people into a false and unwarranted sense of security. With many people wrongly believing global warming has paused when in reality it has accelerated. The article is entitled Distinctive Climate Signals in Reanalysis of Global Ocean Heat Content explains how the strength of recent La Nina events has caused a large amount of heat from global warming to be transferred to the deep oceans. Quote, in the last decade, 30% of the warming has occurred below 700 meters, contributing significantly to the acceleration of warming trend. And so here's what this means in lay language. When you have an Arctic that is substantially free of ice for a substantial period of time, the heat goes directly into shallow water and is absorbed into the bottom of the floor. Normally, it doesn't get there. Normally, when you have ice pack on the water, the heat and sun rays hit the ice and it's bounced back into the atmosphere, not causing us a great deal of grief. When the sun rays hit mountains that are covered in ice and snow, it bounces back. When the snow is melted, it's absorbed into the actual mountain. That causes the mountain to heat, and it causes all of the snow and ice around it to melt too quickly. What we've been seeing, if you've noticed, is we haven't just seen the normal release of ice into water in the spring. We see whole rivers flooded because there's too much melting at one time. Then when it's all melted, it just heats it and holds it, and the ground holds it, and the tundras hold it. Now it's escaping, and this is a changer. This is an earth changer. I'm concerned that in the next 3 years, we will have a major event based upon so much water being so warm and the expansion of the water molecule under heat, and we will see a substantial meltdown in Greenland and in the Antarctic, two major glaciers, one the size of Spain, one the size of France. So we're not talking about tiny little millimeter of rise. We're talking about a foot or two or three. It can now happen. No one can say it can't. Let us hope it doesn't. But then when that happens, and then you have a storm behind that, then you're talking about the virtual devastation of the communities living near the ocean. All I can do is give you fair warning based upon the best science that we know. I sold my place at the ocean. People said that was stupid. Friends of mine, gee whiz, it's so beautiful. Yeah. I believe in getting ahead of a curve, not behind it. I'll forego having that place to live and know that I'm not going to be a victim of my own hubris. I hope others do the homework and see what's going on out there. This is from Ronnie Cummins, the Organic Consumer Association. It's short, and I thought it would be important for you to hear this. Quote, if you put a label on genetically engineered food, you might as well put a skull and crossbones on it. End quote. That was president of Asgrow Seed Company, a subsidiary of Monsanto, quoted to the Kansas City Star in 1994. This is from Phil Angle, Monsanto's director of corporate communications. Quote, Monsanto should not have to vouch the safety of biotech foods. Our interest is in selling as much of it as possible. Assuring its safety is the FDA's job, end quote. For two decades, starting with the controversial introduction of Monsanto's recombinant growth bovine hormone and Calgene's tomatoes in 1994, polls have consistently shown that U.S. consumers are wary, indeed alarmed, about the new technology of genetic engineering. Surveyed regularly, the overwhelming majority of Americans have repeatedly stated that they neither want these frankenfoods, but would actually like to see them banned. And if nothing else, they must be labeled. In a March 2012 national poll conducted by the Melman Group, 91% of Americans said they wanted GMO foods labeled. When asked whether gene-altered foods were safe, 34% of consumers said they believed that gene-altered foods were definitely unsafe. 41% were unsure. 41% said they should be banned. Five counties and two cities in California and Washington have banned the growth of GM crops. In addition, given the near total absence of FDA regulation, 19 states have passed laws restricting genetically modified organisms. Millions of consumers are purchasing over $30 billion of organic food, $60 billion worth of natural foods every year, in part because organic standards prohibit the use of gene-altering seeds or ingredients. But many consumers believe mistakenly that natural foods are genetically modified free as well. The biotech industry and Big Food Inc. are acutely aware of the fact that North American consumers, like their European counterparts, are wary and suspicious of their foods. Even though most consumers don't fully understand the science of gene splicing foreign DNA into plants and animals, they instinctively understand that they do not want to be guinea pigs in a biotech food safety experiment. They don't want their family's health or environmental sustainability decisions to be made by notorious chemical companies like Monsanto, Dow, Bayer, Syngenta, the same corporations who have poisoned our communities and our bodies with toxic pesticides, DDT, Agent Orange, dangerous pharmaceuticals, PCBs. No. These genetically engineered crops and foods have absolutely no benefit for consumers on the environment. They are only hazards. This is why biotech and big food corporations spent $46 million to defeat Proposition 37, a November 7, 2012 California ballot initiative that would have required mandatory labels on GM foods and put an end to the routine industry practice of marketing genetically engineered tainted foods as natural. In the wake of a scurrilous barrage of TV, radio, and direct ad falsely claiming that GMO labels would significantly increase food cost, hurt family farmers, increase the scope and intrusiveness of state bureaucracies, and benefit special interest groups such as trial lawyers, California voters narrowly rejected the vote 51-48. But Big Food apparently now realized that Proposition 37 was a hollow victory, an inconclusive, albeit fierce, preliminary battle in a war against consumer apathy and consumer choice, a war they will inevitably lose. The Grocery Manufacturers Association immediately put a happy face on their narrow victory in California, reciting their standard propaganda. Proposition 37 was a deeply flawed measure that would have resulted in higher food costs, frivolous lawsuits, and increased state bureaucracies. Not true. Now, here is the issue. We've been meeting with more than 37 states, grassroots individuals, to get on the ballots to label genetically engineered foods. We have hundreds of articles. We have multiple documentaries, including our own Seeds of Death. We have a list of at least 40 expert witnesses who can testify, who can lead the local efforts. But it's important at this point in Maine, Vermont, New Jersey, New York, Connecticut, Virginia, the places where you're listening, to reach out, become a member of these grassroots organizations, help them. I told Ronnie Cummins that I believe that the reason that the environmental movement has failed at everything, is because they have trusted the major environmental organizations who long ago sold out. They long ago went to the dark side. If you want to see how bad it is, when I was invited to be the keynote speaker on Earth Day at the UN 2 years ago, the whole room was packed with environmental groups. I had a choice in that moment: say something nice or tell the truth in a way that could not be misinterpreted or mistaken. So I simply talked about how much money each of the groups had received from polluting industries, from the oil industry, the gas hydrofracking industry, the lumber industries, all the industries they're supposed to not touch any money from, and yet they have, and then how they steered their policies away from these issues, and therefore do nothing more than serve their own interest. If the environmental movement is to survive at all, it must survive from grassroots individuals. No one else is going to help you. They've sold out. And unfortunately, a few of the leaders who are well-intentioned just are so politically naive. Getting a bunch of people in front of the White House, chaining yourself up, having a few celebrities is not going to do anything at all. These people are thinking with a mindset that's decades old. But there are ways we can win, and all it takes is one win. Monsanto has to beat us 49 more times. That's not going to happen. And once we do win, we'll have foods that are labeled, then it begins. And then it'll go viral. And then the truth of what's wrong with genetically engineered foods, the truth behind their corrupted science, the truth behind their lies, the truth behind how from presidents to leaders of committees, they have bought influence. They've written their own laws. The corruption of this whole system will come into plain view. Go to our website. Look at all the different groups. Contact them. Reach out. Become active. The future of food depends upon it. I'm Gary Nall. Before we go to our break, when we come back, I'm going to read you from Gaia Health, the latest on paralysis in India, from the polio vaccine. We will then ask Richard Gell, executive producer of the Progressive Radio Network and our one of several scholars in residence. These are people that have been selected because of their independence, the level of their intellect and scholarship, the fact that they are not biased, and that when they're assigned to do a task, they will do it as comprehensively and completely as possible. So when you hear something and it's put up on the web, it can withstand cross-examination in any trial in the country, because we want people to use our material wherever necessary to bring lawsuits against those who have betrayed our confidence. He will respond to Dr. Vicki Hufnagel and her comments about the Sabin versus the Salk vaccines. And then we're going to go to our two guests who are standing by to talk about something that you may not be aware of, the biggest threat economically to the future of the entire planet: derivatives, the credit default swaps, the capacity for creating unlimited debt and then using that debt as an asset. Well, that's economic alchemy. How can you do that? They have been doing it. That will be an insightful discussion. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome all of you from around the world. This is from Jagannath Chatterjee. India has a surge of children with paralysis. The causes are not hard to identify. The oral polio vaccine and redefinition of polio-induced paralysis to acute flaccid paralysis. The result of this fiasco is a plan to give non-live polio vaccines, and it comes at a huge cost, negating the reason for using the oral vaccine. Polio, often thought of as synonymous with paralysis and disability, has been given a new name in India. It is now known as AFP, or acute flaccid paralysis. This and the fact that causes of polio caused by the oral polio vaccine are not being reflected as polio have ensured that India is into its second year of polio-free status. After this charade is maintained for one more year, India will be certified by the World Health Organization as polio-free and will be showcased as a success story of the Global Polio Eradication Initiative that was launched in 1988 by the World Health Assembly. Smallpox was declared eradicated in 1980. According to medical researcher Professor William Merciskin, the experts involved in this exercise were looking for another opportunity to flaunt their skills. When they chose polio, many eyebrows were raised. Polio was not on the priority radar of the countries where this exercise had to be launched. These developing nations were struggling to provide basic health needs. India, for example, was incapable of providing clean water, sanitation, hygiene, and nutrition to the vast majority of its populations, even 65 years after independence. Furthermore, this group had chosen to be the only weapon, their polio vaccine, to eradicate polio. Dr. Jacob John pointed out that this vaccine, consisting of live viruses, is notorious for causing vaccine-induced polio. Because these vaccines, the vaccinated, tend to shed the virus in their stool, it can mutate into a virulent form, causing paralytic polio in others, even leading to polio epidemics. Dr. Annette Padke and others argue that it is not possible to eradicate polio, a disease primarily of poor sanitation and poor nutrition, with a vaccine. Polio, like paralysis, can only be caused by other factors, DDT and other pesticides exposure, even to lead and arsenic, and vaccinations can trigger paralysis. Thus, a holistic approach was needed to tackle the disease. Medical textbooks reveal that exposure to polioviruses rarely results in paralysis. More than 95% of those exposed will show no symptoms at all. Of the rest, many will exhibit symptoms resembling a common cold. A few will suffer temporary lameness, and less than 1% will exhibit permanent paralysis. Exposure to the poliovirus is actually the best immune against viral polio. It offers permanent immunity to more than 99% exposed to it. According to Dr. Yaz Paul, those who become permanently paralyzed may have some inherent susceptibility that should be investigated. Then he goes on to talk about how, knowing this, why in the world would they be doing a massive vaccine program? And yet, last year, quote, 60,000 children there in India became paralyzed because of the vaccine. So how are we helping people when you don't have 60,000 people who end up developing polio? In fact, it was last year, it was, quote, the National Polio Surveillance Project showed that polio eradication program has increased paralysis among children from 3,047 cases in 1997 to 61,038 cases in 2012. And the government does not reveal how many of these cases are due to the vaccine. Let's say hello real quickly to Richard Gale. Hi, Richard.
Hi, Gary.
Explain to the audience the difference between the Salk and the Sabin vaccines for polio and what the actual science shows, irrespective of people's own particular ideas about it.
Well, there was the with the Salk vaccine, which was the first. This was an injectable, so it was a vaccine that went directly into into the bloodstream, and there was numerous cases of adverse effects that came from that, and there was a scandal, and that was pulled. It was reinvestigated. Sabin came along, and he tried to produce a vaccine that would mimic the natural way that a person becomes affected with a poliovirus, which would have been orally through the digestive tract, which is why there was the oral vaccine created. He believed that the better immune system would be done through the gut rather than through the blood. But what people, the production of the virus is still relying upon the monkey kidney cells. And this is where the cause of the problem was with the Salk vaccine. And that problem continues with the Sabin. All vaccine manufacturers claim that there are no contaminants in their vaccines. However, we know perfectly well that every vaccine that relies on a tissue, animal tissue of any kind, is going to have DNA contamination. And this was the case with the SV40 virus. There's still the issue of the relationship of HIV and the polio vaccine. It really has never been been finalized yet, because
but both Richard, we're almost out of time here. Vaccines, both the Sabin and the Salk vaccine, were contaminated. Both failed. And that's what people don't understand. In fact, just to dot the I here, here's the leading scientist in American history on discovering more vaccines, and he oversaw the vaccine at his manufacturing company. This is Dr. Maurice Hilleman. No one questions he is the most important voice historically in the world of vaccines. Here's what he has to say.
And I think that vaccines have to be considered the bargain basement technology for the 20th century.
50 years ago, when Maurice Hilleman was a high school student in Miles City, Montana, he hoped he might qualify as a management trainee for the local JCPenney store.
Tell me how you found SV40 in the polio vaccine.
Well, that was a Merck thing. Okay. Yeah, I came to Merck, and I was going to develop vaccines. Mm-hmm. And we had wild viruses in those days. Remember the wild monkey kidney viruses and so forth? And I finally, after 6 months, gave up. I said that you cannot develop vaccines with these damn monkeys. We're finished. And if I can't do something about it, I'm going to quit. Mm-hmm. I'm going to try it. Mm-hmm. So I went down to see Bill Mann at the zoo in Washington, D.C. And I told Bill Mann, I said, look, I got a problem. I don't know what the hell to do. Bill Mann is a very bright guy. I said, these lousy monkeys are picking it up, you know, while being stored in the airports in transit at these loading, offloading, mm-hmm. loading. He said, it's very simple. He said, you go ahead, get your monkeys out of West Africa, get the African green, bring them into Madrid, unload them there. There are no other traffic through there for animals. Fly them into Philadelphia, pick them up. Or fly them into New York and pick them up. Right off the airplane. So I brought African greens, and I didn't know we were importing AIDS virus at the time.
And it was you who introduced AIDS virus to the country. It was you who introduced AIDS virus to the country. It was
you who introduced AIDS. You heard what he just said, the HIV virus. But he was using the green tree monkey, and that's where they ended up coming up with a known cancer-causing virus, the SV40, the simian virus 40. And he found that the Sabin vaccine was so polluted that when he told Sabin, we've got a problem, and Sabin freaked out, according to him. This is an eight-minute interview. That's why I'm cutting it short, because we have to finish this segment. They decided to cover it up. And he says it. He actually says it. And on a longer program, I'll play the whole piece where he says that we just had to, you know, we couldn't let this out. We couldn't let people know the truth because they would panic. Well, yeah, you just injected millions of kids with a polio virus that's going to cause cancer later in life. Why should they be concerned? Why would their parents be concerned? So anyone talking about comparing the Sabin to the Salk vaccine when it came to polio, they both failed. They both were contaminated. They both failed to do what they were mandated to do. And we have Richard Gale and I have authored 26 articles on vaccines, all fully referenced. You can go to the website and read those at your will. Thank you, Richard.
Okay, thank you, Gary.
Let's say hello now to Dr. Paul Craig Roberts and Dr. Ellen Hodgson Brown. Nice to have you both with us.
Thanks. Nice to be there.
Dr. Roberts, you have to leave quickly in a few moments, but I'll go to you first. I'm very concerned at no level in the United States in the media are we talking about the real problem, the derivative issue. We're not discussing it. Most people think it is not a problem at all. Could you go through, please, step by step and show us what derivatives are, how we ended up allowing this to happen, who are the players, and what is the possible, if not probable, outcome at some point when you have this much money in play by people who have been so cavalier and so criminal in their previous behaviors up to this time, why should we not expect a similar outcome dealing with them and these derivatives?
Well, Gary, that's a big order. Derivatives are bets on interest rates, on exchange rates, on anything they want to bet on, stock prices. I think most of them are based on interest rate bets. The last I looked, the Comptroller of the Currency reported that the four largest banks had something like $230 trillion of derivative exposure. J.P. Morgan Chase alone had derivative exposure equal to or greater than the world gross domestic product. Now, as you said, not much is known about all these derivatives and whether or not any of them net out in some way, but it's for certain that J.P. Morgan doesn't have risk capital equal to world gross domestic product. So these are a massive, unknown problem. The reason, in my opinion, for the quantitative easing, the negative real interest rates that has resulted from the Fed's purchase of over $1 trillion in debt instruments each year, is to drive up the debt-related derivative prices on the balance sheets of the banks in order to make them look solvent or more solvent. The quantitative easing, which is directed at driving up the values on bank balance sheets is, of course, at the expense of the rest of the economy. Savers get no interest on their deposits. But much more important, it's created a massive bond market bubble. It makes no sense to have bond prices historically high and negative real interest rates when $1 trillion of new debt is being monetized every year. It's also created a massive bubble in the dollar. It doesn't make any sense for the dollar's exchange rate to be essentially stable when huge amounts of dollars are being created, a much greater new supply than there is new demand. And so the consequence should be a fall in the exchange value of the dollar. So we have these massive bubbles. And, of course, the money that the Fed is pumping into the banks through purchases of their mortgage-backed derivatives is not finding its way into the economy. The banks are speculating with it in stock futures or in various stock-related derivatives, and so we have a bubble in the stock market. So the policy, which is directed at saving about four banks too big to fail, that's where almost all the derivative exposure in the United States is located, in four banks. So the entire economic policy country is directed at saving these four banks at the expense of everyone else and producing three massive bubbles, the biggest in human history. When they pop, there will be an unimaginable economic instability. It'd be a catastrophe.
I realize that your concerns are that we're not aware of this. We're not having this national dialogue. What do you see as a possible outcome over the next 3 or 4 years of any one of these bubbles collapsing? What would be the outcome?
Well, I think the Fed can print all the money it wants to buy all the bonds it wants to keep the prices up. And as long as it's doing that, it's fueling the stock market bubble as well. But what the Fed cannot do is print money to buy dollars, because you can't buy dollars for dollars. And the Fed is not able to print foreign currencies. So as these movements that we see among the BRICS, you know, the Brazil, Russia, China, India, South Africa, to move away from the use of the dollar in international transactions. They represent about 40%, I think, of the population and the GDP of the world. And so there'd be a huge drop in demand for dollars. Also, the Japanese and Chinese are making agreements to settle their trade in their own currencies. So what you see, while the Fed is producing huge amounts of new dollars, the rest of the world is trying to move away from the use of dollars. So this implies at some point that the supply of dollars in foreign exchange markets is so much greater than the demand for them that the price collapses. And when that happens, all the import prices go up. If you go to Walmart, for example, and you look at all the American brands that we're familiar with, they're all made in China. So if the dollar drops, those prices rise. We will have very high inflation. Of course, the Fed can't keep negative real interest rates when you have a high inflation. And when you have a collapse in the dollar, you have a collapse in the value of all dollar-denominated assets, which includes stocks and bonds. So the potential is for a massive financial wipeout, just a massive.
From what I...
And there's no solution. You can't... There's no policy that can simultaneously deal with economic collapse and widespread unemployment and inflation.
On top of that, a lot of economists now are saying, and people, the talking heads on these economic shows, the dollar's never been stronger in the last 10 years. People are fleeing the euro, and that's only going to give it a greater strength to the dollar, that China is now coming to grips with its own debt crisis, its hidden economy. It's polluted its country into oblivion. It's It's relying upon...
That's all...
That's all they're saying.
Tight cover-up spin to keep people from looking at the problem. And it's true that the euro being in trouble helps the dollar. But... And it's true that the dollar is also helped by the fact that the Japanese are now printing money. But the Chinese, that's a different situation altogether. You know, people say, oh, poor China, they only grew 7% last year. Well, I can't remember in our history when we ever grew 7%. If that's being in a bad situation, we've always been in a bad situation. And what you have forming in all over Asia is an Asian currency block, and they're not going to be using the dollar. They're going to be tied to the Chinese currency. So
when would you see the likelihood of a shift from the dollar being the reserve currency to other mixed currencies?
It's already happening. It's happening now. I think there may not be a reserve currency. You see, the dollar is a reserve currency because after World War II, nobody had anything but us. All the industrial economies were destroyed by the war, including Japan, and the rest of the world was largely undeveloped. Well, now it's quite different. The so-called underdeveloped world now is quite strong economically. You have China, you have Brazil, and of course the Russians have gotten out from under communism. And so the whole tenor of the world is different, so that there's not just one currency. There are now lots of currencies. And many of them, or most of them, probably now more stable than the dollar.
How overvalued do you believe as a percentage Wall Street is right now?
Oh, there's no basis for the prices. You see, the profits they have come from laying off workers, not from a growth in real retail sales. So their profitability is from squeezing cost. And
so the real value could be 7,000. It could be half of what it is now.
Yeah, it could be.
So at some point in the future, and I believe people can have their own opinion, but I believe that the missing link and what could trigger all this is if Israel bombs or goes after Iran. And then the economic alliances that form because of that and the cost of oil, that would give China an opportunity and Russia an opportunity and other countries an opportunity to say, look, you've been posturing, wanting to create another Cold War against us. And, well, we're not going to fight you militarily. No point to that. But we can no longer support you economically. And I don't believe anyone is expecting that scenario, and yet I believe that could be a very important scenario. Your final thought, please.
Well, it's already happening, isn't it? I mean, I don't think it relies on Israel attacking Iran. It's going to happen regardless of that. And in fact, is happening. It's already happening. That's what's unfolding, and they pretend that it's not, and that's why we get the spin about the strength of the dollar. And you know, one of the reasons if you've been the reserve currency for 60 years, it's just tradition. People are used to it. It's just tradition. Long after the Roman Empire fell, the barbarian king still put the Roman emperor on their coins. Because that's what people expected to see on money.
Then for those of us who believe that gold and silver have been intentionally not allowed to rise to what they should be, I believe that will recorrect some of this when the dollar loses value. Thank you very much, Dr. Paul Craig Roberts, for being on and sharing your insights. Always appreciate. And his latest book is How the Economy Was Lost, The War of the Worlds, and his website is paulcraigroberts.org. Now, over to you. Ellen, nice to have you with us again.
Thanks, Gary.
Ellen, I'm looking at Cyprus, and I'm asking, is it possible, even theoretically possible, for any such scenario to happen where you think that your money is your own when you deposit it in a bank, and they don't realize that isn't the case, and then they can automatically take whatever they feel is needed? And this isn't a tax as such, it's a confiscation. And then I have people who I know who said that the Russian oligarchs, who had parked a lot of money there, knew this was coming, and they got their money out. over the last year. But a lot of people got creamed, including a lot of people who were financially rather conservative and live within their means, and they put their life savings in there, and now they're getting 20 to 30% or higher taken off that. And if you realize that that's after they paid their taxes, could you imagine of all the taxes that each of us pays, and then someone goes into a bank account and decides to take 30% of that? Well, I've already paid my tax. I've worked for that. You're taking 30% of my money? For what? What did I do? And Americans are told, won't happen here. We got the FDIC. It's going to protect you. And I'm saying, you're the expert. Could this happen in the United States? And what is the likelihood that this is not going to stop with Cyprus, but this is going to occur in other countries, especially in Southern Europe, Italy, Spain, Portugal, even in Slovakia? Your thoughts?
It could definitely happen in the United States. The FDIC has about $25 billion to protect deposits, and there are $9 trillion in deposits in U.S. banks. So obviously, they don't have enough money to protect all the deposits. And the big Wall Street banks, J.P. Morgan, for example, has $79 trillion in derivatives, and Bank of America has $75 trillion in derivatives, and which is both of them. Well, the world derivatives, I think, the world GDP is $70 trillion. So they both have more than the global GDP. And I think, of course, that's the notional value, but something like $12 trillion in derivatives is actually at risk. That much money is at risk. So if there were a major derivatives failure at Bank of America, let's say, it could easily be a $1 trillion loss, and FDIC only has $25 billion. So it's not a question of taking the depositor's money. The depositor's money is already gone. The question is how to get it back. The Bank of America and J.P. Morgan are gambling with their depositor's money. That's what they've been doing. That's what was just revealed in these recent hearings about the $6 billion loss of J.P. Morgan in the last year. And in Bank of America, the deposits or the derivatives branch, the derivatives were moved from their derivatives branch over to their depository branch, which is where, you know, Bank of America has a huge, I mean, everybody's got an account at Bank of America. That's a typical place for ordinary people to have an account. They have a huge amount of deposits. So those are all now at risk, and there's actually a directive from the FDIC and the Bank of England, dated December 2012, which lays out how, in the event of a major crisis of that sort, what they would do. And what they would do is the only thing they can do. They've lost the money. It's gone. So all they can do is reduce their liabilities to the depositors, which they would do by turning the depositors' debt to equity. So now the depositors would have shares in the bank, but this is shares in a very shaky bank. So it's laid right out there that that's exactly what they would do. And that directive came from, earlier in 2009, the G20 Financial Stability Board, which the G20 nations, including us, signed on to, they were authorized to set regulations for the banks globally, and they have sent out a policy directive where everybody's supposed to have these bail-in policies in place. Canada has one, we know. New Zealand has one. And the New Zealand one is much more explicit than ours, which is pretty vague. But the New Zealand one specifically says they will go after depositors, and there are no there's no secured depositor exception.
Well, for those of us who believe in putting our money into not your commercial banks as such, but into, let's say, a state bank like they have in Montana, or into a credit union, is there any additional protection there or not? Or should we start looking to put our resources into a different place? And what are your thoughts on having backup silver and gold in case there is a confiscation of our cash in corporate and personal accounts in banks?
Well, I definitely think that we should set up state banks. The only state that escaped the credit crisis was North Dakota, because they have their own, basically they have their own banking system, their own credit source, which is the Bank of North Dakota, where the state puts the state's revenues and the state's capital, and they leverage that into loans, just like other banks do. But they act like a mini Fed for the state, where they partner with the local banks, help the local banks to keep loans on their books. They didn't have to sell off their loans like in the rest of the country, where they got into the whole derivatives or the whole collateralized debt obligations, which are packages of mortgages protected with the derivatives, supposedly, which turned out not to be protected at all. So I think that is the solution, is we need to set up some sort of public banking system. And soon in Cyprus, they wound up taking 40% of the depositors over 100,000 euros. Well, that included the pension funds, which were big depositors there. Well, the pension funds is all the people's pensions. So we've all got pension funds that are big money. So they're over $100,000. I'm not sure to what sense they're collateralized. But anyway, all that stuff is at risk, and it's there in Wall Street. Why should we have our money in Wall Street for their gambling purposes?
We shouldn't. Ellen, isn't it also the case that a recent survey showed that the four leading banks, the four that Paul Craig Roberts and you were talking about, were virtually insolvent, and the only reason that they are able to show any profit is because of the enormous amount of money that the Federal Reserve has been giving them interest-free, and then how they've been using that? But if you had to take away all subsidies of these four banks, they would all be broke.
Right. Well, and so the argument is you can't afford to let them go because they're so hooked into this global derivative thing that as soon as one went bankrupt, that would be declared an event of default, and then all the counterparties on these derivatives would try to collect.
Why not try to nullify all of the derivatives?
Well, that's what they have to do. They're going to, I mean, I think they have to nationalize the things, take it over, freeze the derivatives, and net out all the, I mean, derivatives are just bets, and so just say all bets are off.
Yeah,
you
turn on the lights and say
this wins.
This game is over.
Right, but they can't do that unless they nationalize the banks. I mean, they have to take over the whole, the way it's set up right now. And Dodd-Frank, it says we're not going to stop you from doing your derivatives. You can do that. The taxpayers just aren't going to underwrite it. Well, that's not going to work. If you've got to get rid of the derivative scheme, and to
you're
do
right.
that, you're going to have.
Well,
to
we all know Dodd-Frank were totally corrupt in how that was done. I mean, the loopholes in that were just. I was so against that, but then again, I'm not going to wait. I'll have my money out of all these banks. I don't trust the banks. I don't trust the government. I don't trust anybody.
We, the people that pay for them, ultimately.
And we're supposed to trust their integrity?
Because we're the customers.
Yeah. No, I say, you know, let these banks fail. Make all derivatives illegal. Break them down. Nationalize them. But we know that in the current political climate, the corporate Democrats are no different than the corporate Republicans. They're not going to allow that to happen. So we, the people, would once again get screwed. So I'm suggesting people be smarter than what the government and the big banks and the media think that you are.
Well, it will take a huge popular movement, but I think when people start seeing that their bank accounts are getting slashed, they will just be like the Cypriots. They'll be out in the streets.
Yeah, 40%
we'll
of
get
those.
Our movement.
Yeah, mind you, there's what was it? I saw $6 trillion in pensions. You start taking people's pensions when they're already stressed. You take 40% of a pension, you're going to put people out on the street. You're going to have the largest single poverty movement in America happen all at once, and then maybe they'll pay attention. Say what just happened. Ellen, thank you for the good work you do. Ellen's book is Web of Debt, The Shocking Truth About Our Money System and How We Can Break Free, and it's good. Her website with articles about what we can do, webofdebt.com. All the best to you, Ellen.
Thanks.
I'm Gary Nall. I want to thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more on our next program. And I will be here on Sunday night with our Sunday evening program. Now to you, Treece Lead, standing by. She's probably late because she was out getting her money out of the bank. Hi, you, Treece.
First, you have to have the money to put into it to get out of it. But today we are proceeding with our discussion on education, taking a look at the government's role.
Oh, good. Okay. We look forward to it. Thanks. In a moment.